It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin favorite Michael Perry has turned one of his books into a stage show, which will be at Big Top Chautauqua later this month. He joins us to talk about the project.
First, the Red Cross declared recent flooding in Louisiana as one of the worst natural disasters in the United States since Hurricane Sandy. Between August 8th and the 14th, about 6.9 trillion gallons of rain fell on Louisiana, and 13 people lost their lives. The flood damaged about 40,000 homes.
Our next guest is a journalist who's originally from Baton Rouge. She wrote that when she headed back to her home state to cover the flooding, she found it hard to keep an emotional distance, as she usually would on the job.
Julia Griffin joins us now. She's a producer with PBS NewsHour and published a column for NewsHour about how this story was personal for her. Julia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into the personal side of this story, can you give us a sense about the damage in Louisiana and what you saw?
Well, I should clarify that I'm actually still up in D.C., and that is what is difficult about covering the story is not being on the ground. But what we do know is that, you know, about 85,000 people have registered for federal disaster assistance. 13 people have died in this flooding. More than 40,000 homes have been inundated or damaged. And over the course of the last couple days, 30,000 people had to be evacuated.
And I know some of the difficulty is that a lot of these homeowners didn't have flood insurance. This wasn't an area that was supposed to be likely to flood.
That's right. You know, obviously Louisiana is a low-lying state. We have a lot of marshland and bayou areas. But what shocked a lot of people in this instance is this was more inland areas that weren't in the 100-year floodplain, and therefore a lot of families did not have flood insurance, but did not have homes that were raised. And as a result, there are a lot of people that are dealing with a crisis they never thought they'd have to.
And this includes your parents. I think they're in the Baton Rouge area. And at some point, this story was not just a story for you. It got personal. What kind of communication did you have with your parents as this rain started coming down and kept coming down?
Right. They just thought it was going to be another storm. Louisiana's not a stranger to large storms. As of Saturday night, they thought all was well. They went to bed. Sunday morning, I got a text from them saying that there was water at their doorstep. Over the course of the next 6 hours, I continued to get photos and texts from them saying that eventually a foot of water had come in the home. And then around 2 p.m. that time, they were fortunate to get picked up in a boat. It was a friend of a friend's boat, and they were boated out of the neighborhood. And I should mention that, you know, even this was lucky because AT&T cell service was down in the area, so a lot of people cannot communicate with their families. I was very lucky in the sense that we have Verizon, and we could help communicate not only to my parents but to some of their neighbors that were cut off from cell service.
Right. So how did that rescue organization get organized when cell service was down and people were not always able to keep track of each other?
Yeah, that was interesting. A lot of people obviously could still communicate with their cell phones, but what happened in Louisiana, this is the sportsman's paradise. A lot of people are fishermen, a lot of people are hunters. They have boats, and they really felt the desire to get out there and help people as they could. People are now calling this movement the Cajun Navy. And some of the people I've spoken with in the days after said that while they couldn't use their cell phones for self-service, they could go to areas that had Wi-Fi, such as flooded McDonald's that still had electricity, and use their free Wi-Fi systems to look up posts on Facebook pages that had been organized by the so-called Cajun Navy. Now, the Cajun Navy was then coordinating with local police organizations as well as the National Guard and the Coast Guard. And as people were calling in saying they needed help, these entities would then pass those messages along to the so-called Cajun Navy.
We're talking with Julia Griffin right now, a producer with PBS NewsHour, talking about the devastating flooding in Louisiana. And this is, as we're hearing, was personal to our guest, Julia Griffin, because her parents were part of this and needed an evacuation during the flooding. And Julia, you described the extent of the flooding and the damage. So what happens next with rebuilding efforts? Because not a lot of people, as we said, have insurance to get this done.
This is true. FEMA is at the ready. From what I understand, I think people can apply for about what might be a max of about $33,000. That won't be enough for people that had, you know, more than a couple inches of water in their homes. So I think the state as a whole is going to be facing a crisis of how to help these people. That also comes at a time when there's a budget crisis in the state. So I think when people are saying, you know, we want this disaster, you know, more covered in the media, we want people not to forget about it after a couple of days, I think there's something to that because people are going to need some help for quite some time.
Do you think a lot of this could fall on volunteer organizations?
Certainly. You know, we, NewsHour, PBS NewsHour, interviewed the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana last night, and he suggested that if people are out of state and are interested in volunteering, they can go to volunteerlouisiana.gov to organize, you know, group trips and whatnot to come in. But also, as a whole, I've noticed on social media platforms, people that I know who are in Louisiana, there are a lot of posts of churches trying to organize volunteer efforts and local communities coming together. And I should say that this Cajun Navy that was, in a sense, you know, a waterborne entity when this started, has now become a quasi-volunteer network that is helping people with food and cleanup as the waters have receded.
Have the waters receded enough for people to be back in their homes, at least to a degree?
It depends where you are. My parents are in East Baton Rouge Parish, which is, you know, in the more northern part of the flood zone in the state. And what happened is as the Amite River, which is on the east coast of, or sorry, the east border of the parish, as it flooded in the area, it then progressed down more south and flooded other areas in Livingston Parish and Ascension Parish. So while the waters have receded in East Baton Rouge, there are still people being flooded downstream.
Now, you talked about how this was not in the 100-year floodplain. A lot of these residents were not expecting their homes to be flooded. It didn't seem likely. But is there a case that there should have been better preparation in place for something like this?
You know, I think that's debatable. It's an event that, you know, to some degree you can say it's just a freak occurrence. Maybe these things will be happening more often. The state as a whole is, people like to say it's sinking because we are losing marshland and we're losing the replenishment from the Mississippi River. You know, I don't know if you can say that much could have been done. Going forward, perhaps some of these homes could be lifted, put on stilts as many have in the New Orleans area. But again, this was a very special occurrence. There were some areas that got over 31 inches of rain in those 2 days, and that exceeds the 1,000-year mark. So it's not something that people thought were going to happen to them.
We just received some breaking news that President Obama is planning to visit Louisiana next Tuesday. There has been some criticism that the president has not done so yet. Is this something you think that people in Louisiana have been looking for, the president to come and assess the damage and meet people himself?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I've seen posts on social media of people asking, where is the president? It's very reminiscent of what you saw after Katrina. However, you know, there are other people, especially the governor, who say having the president come actually poses more challenges because they have to take resources away from the ongoing rescue and recovery efforts. So it's debatable. I do think that people will appreciate it when he comes, but, you know, it's kind of a point of view of every given person.
Now, you mentioned Katrina a couple times, and you spoke to some people who went through something similar during Katrina. Now they're doing it again. What's the tolerance here for dealing with natural disasters like this in Louisiana right now?
You would think people would be beaten down emotionally about this, but what's remarkable from the people I've spoken with is that it's actually brought people together. And if anything, people feel like they are more prepared because of Katrina. One woman I spoke to said she now knows that as people return to their homes, not only will they need help you know, lifting items and pulling out carpet, but they're going to need food, and they're going to need it on a regular basis. So it's going to be a full-time job for one person just to go out and do those simple tasks that you don't think about. But I think in general, you know, a lot of the things people are seeing are things they've seen before, and it's going to be tough to process. But it's really, in a special way, bringing the people of Louisiana together.
Julia, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish the best to your parents and everyone who's struggling in Louisiana right now.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Julia Griffin. She's a producer with PBS NewsHour. Joined us today to talk about covering the devastating flooding in Louisiana, and she's a Baton Rouge native.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about cooking with stone fruit on this Food Friday.
Right now, Michael Perry is a familiar name and voice on Wisconsin Public Radio. He's a New York Times best-selling author of Visiting Tom, The Jesus Cows, Truck, A Love Story, and more. He's also a musician and is the host of Tent Show Radio, which is heard here on WPR.
One of Michael's earliest books is Population 485. It's a memoir that brings readers into life in rural Wisconsin. That book has been turned into a stage play that will be performed at Big Top Chautauqua on August 28th. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Mike, this is a big switch. This was one of your earliest books. What made you want to turn it into a play?
Well, the idea has been percolating for quite a while, and I have a friend who's a musician who over the years has said we should try to turn that into some sort of stage performance. And I realized last year that if I didn't just set a deadline for myself, we would just talk it to death. So I set I made a nice arrangement with the folks up at Lake Superior Big Top Chautauqua, and they agreed to stage it on August 28th, and that gave me a hard deadline, and then I just got to work.
Now, Population 485 is a memoir. What were some of the challenges of, you know, putting yourself and your friends, neighbors, and family, taking you from the printed page onto the stage?
Well, the biggest challenge is that in order to make a stage play that's not 27 hours long, you have to cut about 85% of the book. And I'm basing that on just word count alone. And that necessitates then a certain amount of composite characters, and you have to do a few things out of order. And that was a little tricky just because as a memoirist working in nonfiction, I always do my very best to get the facts right. I make mistakes, and if they're found or if I find them, I try to acknowledge them. But in this case, you're telling people right up front, yep, you, these two firefighters are now becoming one firefighter. Matter of fact, I called one of my brothers the other day and told him I pretty much wrote him out of the play.
How did he take it?
He did not seem too troubled and just got back on his bulldozer.
Well, what about the friends and the neighbors and the family who do show up on stage? Maybe it's one thing for a book, but to see yourself, you know, personified on stage might be another thing. What was that transition like?
Well, for me, the transition is you turn it over to the actors. If, you know, you write a play because you trust actors, and I've been very fortunate in that we're starting this locally, and we have a great pool here of local actors, and we have UW-Eau Claire has a theater department that has been very gracious and helpful and a source of great advice, as well as some actors. And so I'm pretty good about, like I'm used to cutting my own work. And I'm pretty merciless with myself. And so once I had the words on the page, I've found that the best thing I can do is let the actors interpret the characters as they will and let the director do the directing. I have a quiet word here and there if I think that something needs to be changed for accuracy's sake or to resemble the character more. But mostly, I think you get out of the way. I mean, when I wrote the original book, people said, was anyone upset with you? And you know, you get a few comments, but honestly, the most trouble I had to deal with were people who weren't in the book and disappointed because they hadn't been included. So here you're actually cutting a lot of things out. So I do expect that some folks will wonder why the such and such a story or such and such a character isn't in there. But you do your best to convey the bigger story in a play.
For people who haven't encountered the original book, Population 485, can you remind us what the story is in the memoir and that you're telling on stage?
Sure. It's just that old Can You Go Home Again book. It's been written many, many ways by many different people. And in my case, I wrote about going back to my hometown after 12 years away and being kind of a loner and keeping to myself, but joining the volunteer fire department and meeting my neighbors at that point, one siren, one call, one fire, one ambulance call at a time.
Do you find that that book, I'm thinking about everything that's changed in your neck of the woods since that book came out, you've seen the rise of the Eau Claire music scene and a literary scene of which you're part. Do you think this book was part of spurring that, turning that Eau Claire area into a hotspot?
I would never claim that. Someone else would have to. Yeah, I'm just typing here and trying to keep the kids fed. I'm beyond grateful for that book, because what a privilege to be allowed time and print to write a story about a place that you love and still love. And I don't live in New Auburn anymore. I live fairly nearby. But what a privilege to take a little snapshot. But I've never felt proprietary about New Auburn. It's not my place. It's a place that I'm from and of, and I'm grateful for that. So now I can't, I'm not going to. Someone else have to. I'm just glad to tell the story as best I can.
We're talking to the very modest Michael Perry. His book, his memoir, Population 485, is being turned into a stage play. Michael, I think a lot of us wonder if there's a movie made about our lives. Who plays us? Who's playing Michael Perry in this? Is Michael Perry cast in that key role?
In this particular production, budgetary concerns coming to the fore, we've cast Michael Perry as Michael Perry. Yes.
After negotiations with Tom Cruise fell through.
It was tricky, yeah. There was a lot of back and forth, but right at the last minute. No, I've always said if it ever makes it to the screen, I would like Billy Bob Thornton to play me, ooh, but I don't know if time is going to allow that.
I was just going to say he might be aging out of that role for you.
I might be aging
out
of my
young
role, frankly.
You both play young, right. Well, you said there's a collaborator involved here with you, and that is one of them, at least, is Sean Carey of the band Bon Iver and Jake Lindgren, a director. Tell us about those collaborative parts.
Well, that's great. As a writer, I spend most of my time alone, and I'm pretty happy alone in my little room. But I found lately, in the last couple of years, I've been involved in several collaborative projects, and boy, there's a great joy in being part of a team. And in this case, we have Jake Lindgren directing, another a local guy who has been studying theater for years, started his own theater company, and coincidentally grew up right down the road from the farm that I'm on right now. And so we have that shared sensibility right down to the earth. And then as far as Sean Carey, we met over the course of time through Bon Iver and me working with Justin Vernon, and he too is just one of those folks that you can ask him down, you run into him at the coffee shop and just say, hey, would you be interested in working on this thing with me? And he just says, yeah, and it's about that exciting. You just say, yep, okay, well, we'll see you Thursday then. And but his music is, we just had him at rehearsal the other night, and he was playing underneath a couple of the scenes, and I had a little struggle to go on with his music. Just adds an indescribable element to it.
So there's live music going along with the performance, but it's not a musical, right?
It's not a musical, no. That's going to be a later iteration. We've got to work up the songs. these things do evolve. I mean, this is a work in progress. It's we're going to be presenting a fully realized and finished play up at the Big Top. But I've also learned from studying up on playwriting and reading plays and the history of plays and Thornton Wilder and Our Town that these things changed in their early years. And so there's some evolution. But yeah, Sean is playing. And then also when we're up there, he's going to be joined by Molly O. Molly Stoddard, someone who's played with me in the long beds for years on fiddle / violin, depending on what moon you're in.
You were just mentioning reading up on writing for the stage, playwriting. How was that different for you, the craft of writing a novel or a memoir from writing for words people are going to say? It seems pretty different.
Oh, it's very different, and I'm still learning. And I'm just about everything I've done, from writing to music, I'm learning in public. And that leads to some humbling, believe me. And bringing the first script I had to the actors and watching them struggle with it and realizing that the struggle wasn't them, it was me. And that's what I mean when I say I'm still learning. I'm a real respecter of genres. I'm eager to try other genres, but I never show up assuming I know what I'm doing. And it's been doubly true with playwriting. It's been a real challenge. But I enjoy it. I love being challenged at this point.
Do you have a taste for playwriting now that you've done this adaptation? Could you see writing original plays?
Oh, sure. I think it would be a lot of fun. But I got to get this one tuned first. And again, I can't stress enough, there's so much help out there. I love this area. Just today, I had an email exchange with a theater professor at the university. And, we have these resources right in our backyard. And maybe we aren't big names or famous, but we're willing to work together, and so much can come from that. I'm so grateful for the attitude around here, which is, yeah, let's figure out a way to get this thing started.
Do you think that attitude is Wisconsin, or is that just the attitude that's prevalent in the arts community in general?
I think you can find it everywhere. I'm always really cautious about even the whole, you know, what's happening in Eau Claire has been wonderful, but I'm always really reticent about the idea of saying we've got this scene or we have this special thing, because that pretty soon can turn into self-aggrandizement. And I just think you find good people and you do good work, and that's true whether you're working in New York City or Chippewa County, Wisconsin.
You mentioned that writing you usually do on your own, so this is a different kind of thing, this collaboration on the play. But you're also a guy in a band. Did that give you some experience with the collaboration that paid off in putting the play together?
Actually, I don't collaborate much in the band. I'm the boss. I write them, I sing them, and that's the one endeavor where I'm kind of bossy. But I would say I learned a lot last year in my first experience working with the Eau Claire Music Festival. There I was doing a lot of collaborating and some writing in a style that I hadn't done in years. And one of the things I loved was just seeing that writing appear without my name on it and just as part of the team, part of the crew. And so I felt that a lot. Obviously I have to sit down and did have to sit down all alone and get that script done through many, many drafts, beating it up, cutting it up. And at some point, I just remember feeling like the school kid turning in my paper when I took it to Jake the first time. And our exchange afterwards was much like a school teacher and a school pupil. But I like that. I love input. I'm a guy who just came into this by accident. And so to me, criticism, as long as it's constructive, has never been hurtful. It's always been edifying and growth producing. And I feel the same about this.
Mike, thanks a lot for spending the time with us, and good luck with the show.
You bet. Any information about dates or that sort of thing, bigtop.org or sneezingcow.com, and we're doing a couple of preview shows this Monday and Tuesday in Eau Claire.
Michael Perry is a New York Times bestselling author, musician, is the host of Tent Show Radio, heard on WPR. The stage event of his book, Population 485, is at Big Top Chautauqua on Sunday, August 28th. You can also get information on the WPR-sponsored trip to see it on the Central Time Facebook page, along with some general ticket info. Coming up after the news, Food Friday regular Lori Skelton joins us to talk about cooking with stone fruit. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get our weekly check of the top news stories from around the state with Rob Menser from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin.
First, if you've been to your local farmer's market over the past couple of weeks, you might have seen some stone fruit, maybe peaches, cherries, plums, apricots. For this week's Food Friday, we challenged regular guest Lori Skelton to work these in-season fruits into her cooking, especially her savory cooking.
And what about you? Have you ever cooked with stone fruit? What is your favorite kind of recipe that has peaches and cherries and plums and apricots in it? And do you have a favorite way to cook with this kind of fruit variety? Any questions about cooking with stone fruit and incorporating it into stuff that might be more savory? You can call us now at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your advice, and your recipes. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You'll find a recipe there. Lori Skelton joins us in the studio now to talk about her adventures with stone fruit over the last few weeks. She's one of our in-house foodies here at WPR and a regular Food Friday guest. Lori, welcome back.
Hi there.
So what is a stone fruit, definition-wise?
Definition-wise, it's a fruit where an outer, I guess you'd call it a fleshy part of the fruit, is going to surround a shell, but that's not the seed. The seed is actually the kernel that's inside it. And one of the few things I didn't have a chance to do, apparently you can break into those shells, take out the kernel, roast them, and then use that as a flavoring for creams or ice creams.
Huh.
The French call it noyer, the word for kernel in French. And apparently it tastes like the best almond ice cream you'd ever want to make. The thing is, you need a lot of pits. to make that. And I just didn't get
a good chisel, I guess.
There was some debate in the household as to what is the best way to break into them. Do you just use a hammer, or do you actually need to get your vice grips out?
Wow. Yeah, it seems like a food processor. It would kill your food processor.
In about 2 seconds, yes.
So did you try this at all or not?
I'm hanging on to the pits. I think I'm just going to have to wait for an afternoon when I'm really, really angry with somebody and then just start wailing on them.
Wow. Well, Lori, one of the combinations that you explored and you got pretty inspired by was the idea of stone fruit with herbs. What got you going there?
What got me going there was somebody at the farmer's market, the folks at Carindale Farms. They were the first ones to have sour cherries at the market in early July. And I was asking, what do you use these for when you're doing something other than a pie? And they suggested basil. And I ended up using sour cherries with basil as a sauce. I also ended up making basil gelato, and with a little bit of sour cherry compote, I made a sundae out of that. Cherries and basil is a brilliant combination. Other herbs that seem to work really, really well, peaches with tarragon, apricots, and thyme. And then one of the recipes that I just tried this past weekend paired plums with rosemary. I've always done stone fruit recipes with spices, cinnamon, star anise, even cardamom. That's a no-brainer. But I've never really thought of working with fruit and herbs in this way before. And you can come up with some magical combinations.
You also mentioned that you've tried combining hot peppers, I think it was heat, along with the sweet.
Chili and fruit is always fun to play with. I even made a version of chili over the winter that had peaches in it. And so if you've got any extra fruit around and maybe it's already been grilled or roasted, you can crush that up in your food processor and add it to barbecue sauce. It's really, really good there. You can put chopped fresh or dried fruits in your rice blends if you're making curries. So you've got the fruit with the curry to make a really good combination. And one of my favorite food websites is called Food 52, and they get a lot of people submitting their recipes and then voting on them. They have contests a lot. Their most recent contest was Best Way to Use Stone Fruit, Braised Pork in Cherry Ancho Mole.
Wow.
I have got to try this next time I've got good cherries. And the lovely thing about cherries is when you get cherries fresh, all you have to do is throw them in the freezer. You don't even have to take the pits out. You can just throw them in the freezer. They'll be great for 6 months. So if you do have an abundance of cherries, you don't have to worry about using them up right away. So you can come back for braised pork and cherry ancho mole all the way up to Christmas.
And Laura, you mentioned pitting cherries, which is something that can be kind of a drag when you've got these delicious cherries and it's messy and it stains. And if you've got kids, you can imagine the rest of that story. Do you subscribe to getting a cherry pitter, or do you just do it the old-fashioned way? What do you do?
I have yet to get a cherry pitter. I have yet to find one kind of cherry pitter that people seem to agree on. So I either use a paring knife, or if I don't mind leaving a little bit of the fruit clinging to the pit, poke it through with a chopstick is a really good way to do it. Or I gather some people will use a straw, but straws tend to split on me if I do that. So I use a chopstick.
Huh. I go with a knife and an apron to be sure, because those things really stain.
There was one day when it was a beautiful, relatively cool day out of doors, so I just set up a plastic table in the backyard and pitted a bunch of cherries and then hosed down the table when I was done.
Oh, yeah, that's a great
smart
idea.
Yeah.
We're talking to Lori Skelton, getting lots of great ideas on cooking with stone fruit, peaches, cherries, you name it, but not just, you know, pies and desserts, getting them into savory dishes. And let's get into a recipe now. Lori, we've got this one on our Central Time Facebook page. Roasted chicken thighs you made with peaches, basil, and ginger. We tried this. You brought it in. It was really good. And it didn't, it wasn't super peachy. It wasn't super sweet.
This one surprised me. I've cooked with peaches quite often before, but always when I've been using them as a sauce for something, when other things were added. Again, a lot of spices or other fruits. Peaches would be a component of something. I was skeptical of this recipe by how simple it was. It was just put a little bit of sherry and olive oil in a baking pan, add some fresh garlic and fresh ginger, throw on your chicken thighs on top of that, and then I ended up using twice the amount of basil that the recipe called for. Also, I was using lemon basil instead of straight basil. You throw that in the oven, and in 40 minutes, you've got dinner. I was expecting the peaches to have broken down. I was expecting this to be watery, to be bland, even with fresh ginger. And boy, was I wrong. This was a huge hit when I brought it in for Wisconsin Public Radio colleagues to try. And I'm definitely going to be making this one again. Super easy and absolutely delicious.
It's part of the joy of cooking with stone fruit like this that it tastes like summer. And we're so used to just grabbing a peach or whatever and just taking a chomp out of it. But this way you can play with a little more and extend that summeriness to other dishes.
I was specifically focused on stone fruits that come from Door County at this time of the year because most of what we get in the supermarket is created to withstand long rides in a truck from California, and the flavor just isn't there. And I honestly thought that I'd be just enjoying great, fresh Wisconsin fruit all on its own, that it shouldn't be part of a recipe. Again, I was wrong. Having that extra flavor really does make a difference in whatever you're cooking. So yes, we have a relatively short season for these things. You're right, it does taste of summer when they are that good. But don't be afraid to go ahead and use them in recipes, even if they are coming fresh from the farm just down the road. It does make a difference, and it may give you ideas for what to do when you only have frozen peaches or canned cherries to work with later.
Had a couple of Facebook recipe recommendations from Chris. Chris says, found a great recipe for a peach barbecue sauce for chicken wings online. Yummy,
yes.
Chris writes. And part two, also plums with thyme and dry sherry rolled into a pork roast. Yummy twice. Pork seems like it's going to go well. Pork just seems to go well with fruit, period.
Pork does go well with fruit. I've done a lot of recipes with pork and peaches over the years. And when I first started working on this particular program, a lot of the suggestions I got were pork and prunes or pork and plums, and I ended up not picking the usual things I've done in the past, which would be cook a plum chutney with brown sugar and mustard seeds, or braise the pork with plums and soy sauce and honey, or mix some caramelized onion or caramelized fennel and use that to stuff pork. This was a recipe for pork tenderloin where you roasted the pork separately from the prunes, from the plums, I should say, and the plums were roasted with whole branches of rosemary, balsamic vinegar, a little bit of sugar, and vanilla. Hmm. And I thought, oh, really? And again, it was marvelous. I ended up using a lot less sugar than what the recipe called for, and that did let the wonderful floral aroma of the vanilla play with the floral aroma of the plums. And plums can be difficult because, especially if they are any kind of variant of a prune plum, the skin is going to be very, very tart. It's very hard to pick up a plum sometimes, even when it's ripe, and bite into it and enjoy it because you're always going to be dealing with skin that's not the same as what the fruit is. And that can be a little bit off-putting for some people, which is why cooking with plums can be so grand. Pork is a natural with plums. Thyme and dry sherry makes perfect sense to me. The other lovely thing about plums is that if you are gleaning them from the ground after they've gotten a little bit squishy and have fallen from the tree, which is the way a lot of us are introduced to plums. If you're just walking along a country road and you see a plum tree by the side of the road, you pick up a plum off the ground. If your plums are a little bit squishy, those actually make the best plum jam. And you can make a really easy plum jam with the freezer method. There are a number of ways to do freezer jam that you can find online. Plum jam is super easy and a great way to hang on to fruit that would have just gone to waste otherwise.
We're talking with Lori Skelton right now about cooking with stone fruit on this Food Friday.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite way to cook with things like cherries, peaches, apricots, and plums? Have you gotten creative cooking with fruit? Not just in dessert, maybe in a chicken or pork dish. What are some of your favorite stone fruit recipes? Do you have tips, advice for cooking with these fruits? And any questions? Do you need some advice from Laurie? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find a recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now with Food Friday regular Laurie Skelton, and we're talking today about cooking with stone fruit, things like plums and apricots and peaches.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how to cook with things like peaches and plums and cherries? Have you ever done this? Do you have creative dishes that you make? Maybe a special treat, maybe something you make all the time, maybe something you make when those fruits are in season. Call in now at 800-642-1234 or get some advice from Laurie, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Laurie, I want to talk about the favorite recipe, at least for me, that you made. And I missed the cheesecake one, so that one's not in the running. But you made a delicious couscous salad, and it had smoked salmon.
Oh, yeah.
And
actually, fresh salmon.
Fresh salmon, yeah. Some herbs, and cherries. Tell us about that.
All right. Pork and plums, that I could understand. Chicken and peaches, well, I'd have chicken salad with fresh peaches in it, so I guess the roasting wasn't too far off. But cherries and salmon, that really surprised me. And this was actually sent to me by Judith Sears Poisson when she saw it earlier this summer in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's a great salad. You not only have sliced fresh cherries in the salad with pearl couscous, the big couscous, and a little bit of goat cheese and fresh cucumber and your salmon. It comes with a roasted cherry vinaigrette. Again, this was a real surprise where you take just basic sweet Bing cherries, the ones you can find in the grocery store. You don't have to wait for the farmer's market for these. Just basic black Bing cherries that you take the pits out of and you roast them with a little bit of sugar. And then you blend them in a blender with olive oil, white wine vinegar, Dijon mustard, lemon juice, and salt and pepper. It comes out looking like the worst color of fuchsia you can imagine, but it is so, so tasty. And for even with the sugar, because you've got them roasted and you've brought out other flavors in the cherries, it didn't taste sickly sweet at all. As a matter of fact, I think you said when we were tasting this that it tasted more like a balsamic vinaigrette, and there was no balsamic vinegar in it. It was white wine, about as mild a vinegar as you could get.
You can see a Facebook Live video, not live anymore, I guess, but we did a live tasting on Facebook, and if you ever wonder what we look like when we talk, you can look at us eating that food and talking about it. Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Eric is on the line in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi. I have a family recipe for plum dumplings that came from my grandmother from southern Germany. It is vegetarian German, and that's not an oxymoron.
No.
It uses fresh Italian prune plums, so they're only in season for a week or two. And you take a ripe prune plum, and you wrap it in a dough that you've made from boiled salad potatoes. So it's a red-skinned potato, a low-starch potato. You boil the potatoes, you peel them. Then you rice them in a hand ricer, and you rice it onto a cloth like a kitchen towel so that the riced potato has a chance to cool off and to dry a little bit. You dust it with a little bit of white flour, and then you knead it to make a dough. It's going to be kind of a breakable dough. It's not a real good solid bread dough. And you wrap about a quarter inch thick layer of this dough around the prune plum, which you've washed, and then you boil it as if it was a bagel. And you drop it into boiling water, and as the prune plum starts to cook through, the dumpling will float up to the surface.
Now, is the pit still in there all along?
The pit is in there. You've done nothing to the prune plum except washed it.
Huh.
I think Laurie's going to be making this. She's taking a lot of notes on this one.
Because somebody did suggest that they had a recipe for plum dumplings, But she didn't give me the recipe because she said, you need to take a statin after you've made it. So I think she was a little bit worried about my health at this point. But I've never heard of dumplings with a potato dough. And it's just potato and flour. Any spices in there? Any sugar?
Not yet. The sweetness comes next. Once it floats and it's done cooking, you can tell because it's floated to the surface, you scoop it out with a slotted spoon, and you put it in a frying pan that has buttered and sugared breadcrumbs. Roll the outside of the dumpling, and you coat the whole outside with the buttered, sugary breadcrumbs.
Okay.
And then you serve it with sour cream that's been cut with milk and sugar and cinnamon. You have a cold sour cream, a sweet, cinnamony, cold sour cream sauce on these hot, fresh dumplings, and you eat till you burst.
That sounds fantastic, Erin.
Yeah. Precisely. Wow. Okay. The method has been noted. I may just, especially because as the summer has gone on, different fruits have been coming into season, and it's only in the last couple of weeks that plums have started to show up. So if there are any plums at the market this weekend that are of that Italian prune variety, the ones that are dark purple and a little bit elongated, those and a little bit smaller also, I will definitely give this a shot. Thank you for giving me that recipe.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm one of those people, Lori, who doesn't like the bitterness in the skin. My family loves it, but I can't stand it because of the contrast. So this is a great one to try. Well, Eric, thanks a lot for that. And let's go next to AJ in Milwaukee. AJ, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share about stone fruit?
So what we like to do is pickle the stone fruit because A, you can preserve it for, next winter and things like that. And a lot of the different spices that you can use in the pickling process actually gives, that those stone fruit new life and new other applications in terms of savory dishes. Like, it works really well as, a garnish on top of meat because you've got that acid that'll cut that rich piece of meat. You can put it in risotto and things like that or with fish. And we love to pickle, pickled cherries, pickled peaches, pickled plums.
Yep.
All of it works just really, really well.
I did put up some pickled cherries. I did pickled cherries and then brandied cherries using Alice Waters' recipes from Chez Panisse. And I was really surprised. She had allspice and cinnamon and hot chili peppers in her pickle. So they're not quite ready to eat yet, but, I agree with you. What is your favorite way to pickle a peach?
To pickle what part of me?
The peach.
The peach. So I like to do a little bit of coriander, a little bit of ginger, and a little bit of chili, and some rice wine vinegar works really well.
That is brilliant. Thank you.
You have to chop them up before you pickle them? I imagine with a peach you would have to do slices or something, right?
AJ, what do you think?
Cut them in half, twist them off, pop the pit out, and just pickle the halves.
I like that.
Okay.
That's a great idea.
That's a fantastic, because then you're still going to have a little bit of fruit in the middle that's not quite as pickled, right?
Yeah. So that's why by cutting them in half and then packing them in the jar just tends to work better. I've noticed that over the length of time sitting in the liquid and then during the pickling process, they don't get as mushy.
That is brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you so much, AJ. We haven't gotten into apricots as much. I don't even know when apricots are in season, honestly.
We had them about a month ago, a very short season for them in Wisconsin. I like apricots, but I've never been blown away by the ones I get in the store. A couple of weeks ago on the Great British Baking Show, somebody made something with fresh apricots, and Mary Berry noted that because you use fresh apricots, this will be very sharp. And I'm thinking, I've never tasted a sharp apricot in my life until I had some from Egg Harbor. It's Barnard Farms, and they were amazing. Sharp, bright, complex flavor. I ended up using those for a compote with Mario Batali's take on American Indian pudding, which has a lot of molasses in it. Again, that sharp fruit against that heavy sweetness. Beautiful, beautiful contrast. And the other one recipe that I really, really loved was marinating lamb in a heavy curry sauce for what they call a sossati in South Africa, a skewered lamb kebab that's served with apricots on the skewer. First time I've ever grilled an apricot. It's brilliant.
Wow. So, Lori, has this changed your cooking life? Just briefly.
I've always enjoyed working with stone fruit. I'm looking forward to dams and plums that are coming in from Weston Antique Orchards very, very shortly. I've always enjoyed it, but having the concentration this time, I've gotten so many different ideas, and I'm going to be busy for a while.
Nice.
Lori, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Lori Skelton, one of our cooks here at WPR, regular Food Friday guest. You can find a link to her recipe for roasted chicken thighs with peaches, basil, and ginger. That's over on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, still time for you to share your stone fruit savory food favorites. Today is World Photo Day, an international effort to get people to share their best pictures. The date marks the release of the daguerreotype photo process. I'll just assume I'm saying it right. That was in 1839 when the French government purchased the patent and then said, hey, we're releasing this to the public. It was the first practical photographic process.
And so what about you? Do you have a favorite picture that you've taken? Maybe lately, maybe over the years? Well, you can share that picture with us on Central Time, and also with the rest of the world. Let us see your work on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also tweet us, send that tweet to @CentralTimeWPR.
Now, you may not know this about, you do know this about me. I'm a very, usually very bad photographer. Are you good?
I have a decent eye, and once in a while I get a lucky shot, and I've got one of those, my son on the ferry from the North Island of New Zealand to the south. His hair is windswept. The lighting is perfect. His eyes look luminous, and I've never been able to duplicate anything like that since.
Yeah, I got one great waterfall picture that my dad framed for me. I had Douglas Houghton Falls in the Keweenaw Peninsula in the UP, and I'd climb down this ravine to look up at the falls, and I ended up with a picture. I'll never take another picture as good as that one, but I have at least one keeper. How about you? Share your best photo ever with us on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.